Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you accommodating this change. I had an abrupt change in my schedule that I have to leave shortly. So I'd like to acknowledge Cindy and Molly as the co-authors for this presentation. And I'm going to cover the sulfur management in the Northern Great Plains. And as you can see, pardon me, in the last summary from the International Plant Nutrient Institute, there are quite a few soils in the Northern Great Plains indicated in black color that are deficient with a definition of less than three parts per million in the Great Plains. Now, this is a little bit lower than what we use as a cutoff of 5 parts per million, so that number may be a little bit higher than what is indicated in the survey by IPNI. Our major focus on sulfur, of course, is canola. And I'm going to concentrate in the management because probably 90% or even more of the management of sulfur in the Northern Great Plains pertains to canola. And to a lesser extent, cereals, including corn, which is recently, has the issue of sulfur deficiency has been addressed very recently. And just to show you why canola is the major player is because this is actually some data of the canola production, the acreage in the Northern Great Plains. 6 million of that belongs to the Western Canada, and the remaining is the Northern Great Plains, the United States. And as you can see, there is a steady increase in the hectares that are being occupied by canola. And as the price of it becomes more lucrative, guess what? the acreage is going to get greater, and the demand for sulfur will be greater as well. So the steps in sulfur management are, of course, to identify the sulfur deficiency, and Graham gave us a very good description of the problem and challenges that we have. So I'm not going to be spending very much time on it. Then the development of regional recommendations, and finally the correction of the deficiency itself. So, of course, with the identification of the deficiency, we have to take a sample and then we have to analyze it. And guess what? Both of them are really, really challenging. Back in the 90s, I was running, actually starting in the 80s and continuing on till 1997, I was running the provincial lab in the province of Saskatchewan. And at that time, I did a number of studies. This is just an archaic way of illustrating the problem from sampling, but this is from a quarter section in Saskatchewan where we sampled in a 20 by 10 grid every 45 inches going east-west and every 45 yards east-west and 75 yards north-south. And if you do the average of the soil test in this field is 42 pounds per acre or 21 parts per million, which is above the critical level of any application of sulfur for any crop. And yet, 65% of the field are sulfur deficient. So we have some major challenges with the spatial variability of sulfur simply because the soils in the Northern Great Plains are marine deposits, and there are gypsum crystals scattered in the soil, either in concentrations or far apart, and they will skew the soil test. So actually in the lab we used to take a pound of soil, split it into 10 parts and analyze them separately and have maybe 8, 9 of the sub-samples with 8, 9 ppm and one with 90. So because of a gypsum crystal, which will skew the soil test, but probably won't have any impact as far as recommendation. Also, this is the, now from the methodology, normally people are using dilute solution of calcium chloride or potassium chloride. And these are actually the QA/QC data from the lab that I took with me when I left in 1997. And these are the controlled limits, which is the, the three standard deviations above the standard that we were using. And 3.4 ppm can take you very easily from a deficient to a sufficient soil. So the error in the analysis is fairly large. And when we did a study to analyze where the error was coming from, 80% of it was due to the matrix, which is the soil. So even if we have the perfect equipment, if you wish, still we're dealing with a great variability, which is due to the soil. So our recommendation to the farmers is if you have a sulfur deficient, if your soil test says your soil is deficient, well, you have a sulfur deficiency. If it doesn't, who knows? Could be anything. Since our effort is concentrated on canola, I thought I should share some sulfur deficiency symptoms with canola. This is earlier on. They're manifested and expressed as a cupping of the leaves. And that cupping continues on into the early bud stage. You can already detect in the picture that the flowers are kind of a white yellowish color. And as we move into the flowering, you can see on your left-hand side how sulfur deficiency is expressed in the flowering stage with canola, those white, yellow-white color versus the on the right-hand side, you know, the bright yellow color. Now, this color will be perpetual in essence. In many of my experiments where I had to do sulfur deficiency, dealt with sulfur deficient soils, I had to desiccate at the end of the fall in order to get a yield out of them. They can flower forever. But also, when you get to the final stage where you're harvesting with canola, you can see how miserable, if you wish, canola looks like as far as, you know, a deficient canola versus sufficient, which is the bundle on the left bottom corner over here. So as far as development of regional recommendations, most of the calibration work was done back in the 70s. Mike, I'm thrilled to hear that there is calibration happening in Australia. This is a foreign, you know, concept in Canada, and I'm sure in the U.S. to a certain extent. You know, we just don't do that anymore, you know. So there were ad hoc adjustments to those recommendations, especially when the hybrid canolas came along, you know. And just put together some general recommendations for the area. Normally, for cereals, we use the five parts per million, and normally you will see a recommendation of 10 kilograms per hectare or pounds per acre, whatever you want to call it, as a general recommendation for cereals, small cereals. Canola and other oil seeds tend to be a little bit more responsive, so there are a few more categories, if you wish, as far as defining deficiency in the different climatic zones, agroecological zones within the Northern Grain Plains. So you have the arid, areas, the dry and the humid areas, and of course there is a bit of variability. Actually, what I did, just to illustrate that pretty much all the labs that provide recommendations in the area give similar results, is submitted a number of samples to these four major labs, five actually, in Western Canada. And I got back their recommendations, and the soil tests were very close. And as you can see, the recommendations in the ballpark. You know, we're talking for a very deficient soil between 15 to 20, 25 kilograms per hectare, and borderline between 10 to 20 kilograms per hectare. So the labs in the area tend to generate similar recommendations for sulfur. And then we come to the correction, and that's where the fun begins, because we have all kinds of interesting situations with products as well as rates used. And actually, I use the principle, the IPNI 4R principle, in describing the situation with the correction of the deficiency. In other words, using the right source at the right rate, the right time, and the right place. And I will start with the most fun part of the presentation, which is the right source. And there are all kinds of different sources that are out there. They've already, Cindy described in detail. All I'm going to say, there are three categories: sulfates, there are considered immediately available, thiosulfates, which are almost immediately available, and then, of course, elemental sulfur products that would require oxidation in order to become available. Now, oxidation in Western Canada is something different than in Australia. Let me make clear, because what I'm going to show you probably is going to be in direct contrast to what Mike showed you not very long ago. This goes to some work that Henry Jansen from Air Canada and myself did back in the late 80s, and we published in 1990, and shows actually the sulfur that was oxidized from three sources of sulfur. This sulfur was applied at various rates, 0, 30, 60, 90, and 120 kilograms per hectare. And it was applied in the fall. And then we'll examine the oxidation rates in the following spring. And as you can see, this is in the spring, and this is your ammonium sulfate. You can see there is hardly any oxidation early in the spring, and that is late April, early May. Going into June, there was some oxidation. This micro S is actually a suspension sulfur, flowable sulfur, that we purchased from, actually at that time, from Spokane, Washington. And this is the ammonium sulfate, and this is your 009 or Tiger 90 as it is known. And of course, in the fall again, you can see that there were quite a bit residual levels from the 200024, which is your ammonium sulfate, and the suspended sulfur. But as you can see, the increase of the sulfate over the control with elemental sulfur or T90 was minimal. And that sets the stage for how the oxidation rates occur in our soils in the northern grain plains. These were actually... the rates were broadcast, not incorporated, left on the surface. Just to get a sense of the issue that we have with granulated elemental sulfur, it doesn't matter what the product is, what the name is, when you granulate it and you put it into the soil, effectively you encapsulate the elemental sulfur. And 2 months later, you can see we dug that out and we put a granule right next to it, just to give you an idea of how the oxidation is so slow, because the bacteria just oxidize a very small surface area. They cannot actually enter into the granule to oxidize it. On the other hand, leaving it on the surface, the action of rain, and especially if you do it in the fall, the action of freezing and thawing can have an impact on the breakdown of the elemental sulfur, but still, there is not, you know, the oxidation happens in July, August, when by that time, most of the requirements for the plant have been fulfilled. There is the product that Mike mentioned from Mosaic that has half of it is in sulfate form, which is available form, half is in elemental form. And the only piece of information I could find in Western Canada is not even a field study, it's just a master's thesis that was done back in 1995 at the University of Manitoba, Don Fladen's student. He looked at the Czech elemental sulfur, this product, as well as ammonium sulfate, as far as sulfur uptake, and as far as yield in pots. And the moral of the story is that if you have severe sulfur deficiencies, again, the elemental sulfur component of the product is not available in the year of application. There is a study, there are a number of studies actually, and Dr. Molly is one that has done probably most of them in Melfort. I was involved in two of them back in the 80s, and then I repeated the same thing in the early 90s. Early 2000. My apologies. And this shows the work from Dr. Molly that compared different sources of elemental sulfur. Now, the way that he did, he would apply 20 kilograms of sulfur in these different forms, and he would grow canola, canola wheat canola rotation. So the first year is canola, the second year is canola, but the first year was wheat grown. It was wheat that received the 20 kilograms per hectare. And then in the third year will be the canola yield canola rotation. But all the rates of 20 kilograms per hectare of sulfur were applied in the spring. No sulfur, ammonium sulfate, ammonium thiosulfate. This is what we know as a T50, which is a 50-50 blend of elemental sulfur and ammonium sulfate, and of course bentonite sulfur. And as you can see in the year of application, in the subsequent, well, actually there was some oxidation in the third year, but as you can see, ammonium sulfate, the original 20 kilograms per hectare of ammonium sulfate and ammonium thiosulfate carried through the 3 years of the experiment. Whereas the product, and the reason for it is because you can see later on, once you band or incorporate that product, is just gone. And that's how the plants were. They had received the elemental sulfur in 1996, looked like in 1997, and these are the plants that had received the ammonium sulfate in 96. And that's how they looked in 1997. So, you know, you can see the canola deficiency. That's some of the work that I did. It's published somewhere or another, Canadian Journal of Soil Science or Plant Science. And this is, again, in a three-year rotation. We applied, actually, all these sources. What we had done is we had disconnected the application from the seeder. So as we were seeding, those sources were broadcasted on the surface of the soil. We got full yield response in the year of application with ammonium sulfate. Sulfur 95, they blew up their plant. Doesn't exist anymore. In 2000, we grew barley. There was a significant response, actually, with all products. So as you can see, in that particular case, oxidation in the second year allowed us some response with barley, but barley is not very responsive. In the third year, pretty much, you know, all the sources gave equal responses, and it's the situation here where you have all these ABs, you know, A's and ABs. So this and these are significant different. The other ones are in between. So you can see there is a residual effect in the third year of the application. Just to get an idea, this is how the experiment looked in the first year. These are the different elemental sulfur products in this particular field. And then we superimposed 12 ammonium sulfate rates. And you can see how those experiments looked like. There is severe deficiency. We had to go and desiccate at the end of September to harvest the canola in our environment. As far as broadcasts sulfur, there is again some work from Melfort, Saskatchewan, when Adrian Johnston was with Ag Canada, now he's with IPNI, where they surfed broadcast different sources with alfalfa. And this was, of course, the first year the sulfate T9, S95. Second year, you can see the residual effect of all. You know, third year, again, the elemental sulfur, for whatever reason, it started lagging behind. And I think part of the reason, I think, it is because it's oxidized slowly, it also gets immobilized quicker by the soil microorganisms, and that's why it's not available. So anyway, those are 50 kilograms per hectare broadcast with alfalfa. What about the right rate? This is the classic experiment by Marv Nyberg that actually identified the nitrogen-sulfur interaction in Western Canada, where he had applied NPK, both in canola and barley in Alberta, and he got actually a yield reduction by applying NPK. And then when he did apply sulfur with the other three nutrients, he got this huge increase in the yield. And that, of course, set off the nitrogen-sulfur interaction. There is a series of publications on it from University of Alberta, University of Saskatchewan, and other places. And now, what happened subsequently is I came along and kind of disturbed the situation a little bit, and that happened when the canola hybrids came into place. I had a very big research program back in my research days where I was comparing hybrid canola to open pollinated canola or conventional, and these are the average of 17 side years of comparison. This is your open or conventional canola, and this is the hybrid canola. And you can see with conventional canola, you get to a maximum yield, and then what happens as you add nitrogen to the system, you have actually a decrease as a result of the nitrogen-sulfur interaction. We were able to correct this and bring the yield here, but not higher, by adding 40 kilograms of sulfate sulfur. But you can see with the hybrid canola, for some reason, we kept on going up and up and up. So if I go back for a moment and separate the conventional or open pollinated canola, this is the control and this is the 40 kilograms per hectare. You can see the response to sulfur with the open pollinated canola. And this is 17 sites, as I mentioned, site years. What happened though with the hybrid canola, we couldn't see that response. And actually there was a master's thesis that was done at the University of Manitoba that actually established in an indirect way that hybrid canola is a better scavenger of not only of sulfur, but all the nutrients as well as moisture, water in the soil that has a tremendous impact on the fertility of the following crops. So, you know. So anyway, then we followed up with another 10 side years, looking at the response at three different ratios of nitrogen to sulfur, and we had some separation with conventional canola. Mind you, those experiments were done on soils that were sulfur sufficient with a soil test. But there was absolutely no impact with a hybrid canola. Because as a result of that balance, people misinterpreted, if you wish, the recommendation, that nitrogen to sulfur ratio, which is something that you will see with open pollinated canola, especially on very deficient soils. But even on soils there was enough sulfur in them, people will recommend that you adhere to a nitrogen to sulfur ratio. That was part of the work, you know, in terms of sulfur rates. Now, you look, for example, in Western Canada, nobody is generating zero recommendation for sulfur for canola. It's just as simple as that. You know, even if the soil test is off scale, which is going to be probably in 85% of the time, there will be a 10 pound per acre or, you know, 12 kilogram per hectare, if you wish, recommendation because of the spatial variability of sulfur more so than anything else. In terms of the right rate, of the right time, I meant to say, this is again taken from Dr. Molly's experiments with two rates, 15 and 30 kilograms of sulfur applied as Tiger 95, elemental sulfur 95, and ammonium sulfate applied in the fall and in the spring. And as you can see again, there is some oxidation, actually quite a bit of significant oxidation of these products. And again, these are broadcasted. I want to emphasize that. But the maximum yield, the best management practice, if you wish, is ammonium sulfate applied in the spring. And that's just a clear message from this study as well as from many other studies. There is a post-emergent sulfur application. There is a small window of 4 to 6 weeks for applying. Actually, Dr. Molly, again, is responsible for most of the work. Now, sulfur is absorbed in a gaseous form, and we start having sulfur deficiencies when the Clean Air Act came into place. Before that, we didn't have any sulfur deficiencies, so we know that. And there is some limited research on foliar application of sulfur there. Its absorption by the leaves is fairly low. So, but nevertheless, here is some work that Molly and Leach published in 2003 with different at two sites with different times of sulfur application sideband preceded. So up to here, the first three are at seed time, and the rest of them are applied. And now this side, there was hardly any response, as you can see. At this side, there was actually some benefit, but you look at the rates there. I mean, it was applied at 18 gallons per acre. That's practically now somebody carrying that much water around. You know, it's not a practical thing. From an experimental point of view, you can carry it out, but from a practical point of view for a farmer, it's a very expensive and also high risk practice. So sulfuric seeding always provides the maximum yield. I don't want to say that there is no problem with cereals, and I just thought I should show you some of the, you know, a couple of slides. We do have some severely sulfur soils where you may see sulfur deficiency with cereals. And also there is some notion, and there is some research that we carried out actually back in my in the heritage company that I used to work for, Wesco. The notion was that because, of course, sulfur is part of two amino acids, that when you apply sulfur, you increase the protein in the grain, and we were not able to demonstrate that benefit in this series of experiments. And I just want to wrap up with right place, and just by showing this slide with, again, from Dr. Molle's work, where he compared different placement. Ammonium sulfate was either banded or broadcast applied. There was no significant difference in those two, so I lumped them together. So this is ammonium sulfate in 1996, again, the same study that I showed you before, except now shows the different placements. Ammonium sulfate broadcast or banded, broadcast, band, and seed row elemental sulfur, same as the control. You can see by the third year there is the residual effect from broadcast applications of sulfur starts showing up. Some benefit from seed row placement, but not maximum yield. These are all residual. And of course, no benefit from banding elemental sulfur. So with that, I gave you a very quick rundown of the sulfur management in the Northern Great Plains. So I don't know if we have any time for questions. Thank you.